Full Story is supported by AMP Super. There are moments in life where everything shifts. A new job, a new home, a new direction. But those same moments can also shape your future. AMP calls these super moments. Times to check in on your super. And with 24/7 digital financial advice, AMP Super helps you make more confident decisions as your situation changes. Search AMP Super Moments to find out more. AMP Super. Built for life's super moments. AMP Super, issued by NM Superannuation Proprietary Limited. See PDS and TMD on amp.com.au and consider what's right for you.
This is The Guardian.
I'm Barry Cassidy.
And I'm Tony Barry.
Welcome to a back-to-back Barry's from Guardian Australia. Well, the government's tax changes, primarily targeting investors, has been introduced to the Parliament. 2 weeks after the budget, still the debate rages, and the government hints they'll make changes at the margins, but the structure stays. Will that attitude hold? Other issues, independents, some of them contemplate their future. Will they try and form a party? And last week's Redbridge poll that basically pointed to One Nation being the official opposition after the next election does demand a closer look from the pollster himself. But the budget first and the wash-up. And, Tony, the government says they need to legislate now in an overarching way, right? Overarching legislation in broad terms. And if it needs a bit of adjustment along the way, they'll do that by way of amendments later on. Now, they say this is common practice. It doesn't feel routine to me.
No. It's Ronald Reagan always used to say, when you're explaining, you're losing. And the last 2 weeks, they've been trying to explain and very unsuccessfully. I think back to the GST with Costello selling that. And, you know, he was all over it, all across the detail. He persuaded a lot of people. A lot of people weren't persuaded. But he never made a mistake. And you look at these guys in the last 2 weeks, you know, Tanya Plibersek, who's one of their stronger performers, she was being asked about testamentary trusts. She clearly did not know what that was, and she mixed up the taxation treatment. Yep. But, you know, you've got to be across the detail. You know, if you want to give people the confidence that you're doing the right thing, that you know what you're doing, we had Tim Ayres out later in the week, also sort of seeming to fall over himself, mixed messages on how far they're willing to go with exemptions. So I don't think it's been a stellar 2 weeks. I did see Sam Maiden write a piece saying this was totally expected, that, you know, they knew it'd be going in for rough waters, and I think that's correct. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't explain their sort of not being across the detail and not really having a message to sell it. So I think they're in for a rough time. And I think we've discussed this recently, that Albo was clearly, because he's very much about parliamentary process, he thought, I need to do something that the Greens will support so we can get it through, because they only need the Greens in the Senate to support legislation. I'm not going to make the mistake of Tony Abbott and bleed to death for 2 years and get nothing through.
Yeah.
But of course, if they come back, if they sort of pass it and then come back and make changes and amendments, they're still bleeding.
Yeah, if they're minor, and they should really, there are a couple of things that I think they will deal with. I think the definition of a small business, you know, $2 million is probably a bit low, and they might go a bit higher, something around the startups. But I don't think the changes will be significant. The important thing, though, is they now face a 3-week Senate inquiry, so that further keeps the debate running. But I do think, though, they've been quite resolute, and Jim Chalmers is certainly across the issues and the detail, no doubt about that. And I think Anthony Albanese has been quite resolute. There is the hesitation, and that's where it gets interesting, because if hesitation turns into constantly going back to the thing and rejigging it, then the cracks could open up.
Yeah, Howard was resolute too on work choices, and we saw how that turned out.
Yeah.
So you've got to be cautionary.
I don't think it's work choices, though.
No, but I reckon there's probably...
With work choices, it hurt the wage and salary earners, and this is the reverse of that. It's trying to put those who invest in alignment with wage and salary earners. So it's a different constituency that's having a grizzle about it. And I think what would please both Jim Chalmers and Anthony Albanese is that their constituency is so determined on this one.
Work choices, I was at Crosby Textor doing the polling at the time. It was a slow burn. George Wright, who's a wonderfully talented fellow, was running the ACTU campaign, which was quite brilliant. You know, he'd have ads of single mums being called up by the boss, you know, with a sick kid being asked to come into work, those sort of things which were highly emotive and sort of galvanised support behind the unions on that messaging. But I think in terms of this, there's a lot of oppositional voices out there. Yes, sure, a lot of them have vested interests, but it's been unusual in that sense. You don't normally hear such a wall of noise opposing the government on any reform. So they've got their work cut out, I think.
You don't, but it's media-driven, and a lot of it is, I think, out of self-interest, and they're picking and choosing groups who they quote. I want to give you one example of a column that really caught my eye this week from Tom Hurd. Mm. Tom Hurd is he runs an economic consultancy company. He says he was a wage earner. 20 years ago, he formed a company to do much the same work, and now he's doing the same work, but he pays much less tax. He's taken advantage of numerous tax breaks. He had a family trust. He distributed income to family members at lower tax rates. And he said, yes, we work hard, but not because we are saints. We do it to reduce taxes. People do play by the rules, but that doesn't mean the rules are fair. And this was his conclusion. The government is asking some of us to pay a respectable minimum. That may be bad news for some tax plans, but it's not bad policy. Now, the Tom Hurds of this world, I don't think, are getting a fair go. They're not breaking through in the media. He did, but those who share that view are not getting the same run as those who stand to lose.
Yeah, it's one thing to look at legacy media, but when you look at social and digital media, my feed, which is very broad, I follow Labor people, Liberal people, so I get a lot of different algorithms. But I think it's a fairly representative cross-section that I get. And the voices against it have been massive. I've seen very little in support. I did read that column in legacy media. But there's clearly something happening under the radar here. And it makes me wonder if, One Nation, which I think is a lot more sophisticated than we give it credit for in terms of campaigning, one of our senior researchers at Redbridge, Alex Fine, she's probably in the field more than any of us every week talking to Australians all around the country. And she wrote a really interesting piece on the Substack about One Nation. And one of her observations was, you know, something we've discussed before, which was about Gina Rinehart's plane to Pauline Hanson. And far from people being repulsed by that, they were like, that's great. You know,
impressed.
Pauline Hanson's an outsider like me, and finally an outsider is getting the baubles.
Gina Rinehart is not an outsider.
Yeah, I know, but they see Pauline. And she also made this point. She said qualitatively, you know, when they talk about Pauline, you know, as their wrecking ball, as their voice, as their truth teller, they're talking like a friend, you know. They use Pauline. And that sort of terminology, that familiarity. But she also made the point, the Pauline Hanson animations, please explain, which have been around for a couple of years now, and they're very clever. And somewhat ironically, the studio that produces those are around the corner from me in Fitzroy, which is the last place you'd expect these things to be produced. But they are brilliantly clever, whether you agree with them or not, and they reinforce voter prejudices against the major parties.
I want to come back to that and Pauline Hanson when we get on to the polling topic that I foreshadowed. Mm. But an email this week from Sholto Maud. It's a very long email, so I'll paraphrase. But he took issue with how he interpreted something that I said last week around that rents had gone up since the budget. And at the Sydney Writers' Festival, what I said is that, you know, I have no idea whether rents have gone up, but if they have, they shouldn't have. Mm. But he went to realestate.com and had a really close look at the situation in Melbourne, and he's persuaded that they've jumped by about $100 per week in the last few weeks. But my point about that is landlords now, existing landlords, cannot blame the budget for this because by definition they're landlords now and therefore their investments are grandfathered.
Yes.
And so the point that I was trying to make is that they have no moral and no economic reason to be raising them. But the further point he makes, he says, I don't agree, and this is a quote, the government has any entitlement to the capital gains I make on my investments at all. Well, that's just not sustainable. Of course, you have to just as you tax wages, you have to tax capital and profits, and that's been the case for decades. That's not the issue. It's the issue is the level at which they tax those profits. But, you know, again, I just make the point, you can't tax-affected worker and not a passive investor. So it's a distortion in the system. But he went on to make one interesting observation. Why, though, with shares, when young people are trying to find ways of saving money and get a deposit on a house, why can't their capital gains tax be means tested? Now, that to me would be rather complex. Mm. It would open up a whole new avenue, but it's not a bad thought.
Yeah, but we've already seen in our research there is resistance to that amongst young people because they have invested in shares. Mm. And again, going back to that attention to detail, I'm not sure if you saw that went sort of viral, but Billy Fitzsimons, who's runs a website targeted at millennial voters, and she's been a journalist for about 10 years, but she interviewed Jim Chalmers, and look, I wouldn't say it was the GST birthday cake, but she was all over it, and he had to consult his papers. He was thumbing through it. It didn't look great. Mm. It was certainly not a catastrophic, but for someone like Jim, who's, you know, usually very well prepared, but, you know, she went straight to the heart of it, which is there was a discrepancy in the figures from the ATO compared to ASIC. And of course, ATO are often using those who've disposed of capital assets, mm. which is different to accumulation.
Mm. Look, on the poll, because unfinished business here, because last week you were aware of the polls, you couldn't release them because you had an obligation to a client, but now we can. And just recapping, the Liberals, according to your polling, would be reduced to between 7 and 21 seats in a 151-seat parliament.
Yep.
Labor, on the edge of minority government, One Nation, 50-plus seats, and the official opposition. That's pretty much the story. But I'm interested in the methodology. The sample is about 6,000.
Yep.
And that's big.
Yep.
Also, there was a seat-by-seat component to it. Yep. How does that work?
Look, it's without sort of going into a 20-minute explanation, and Dr. Sean Ratcliffe does all our field work on this, it's like-for-like data. So it starts building a demographic profile because we ask, you know, questions about blue-collar, white-collar income levels, tertiary and so forth, you know, inner, outer, suburban and so forth. And so then it's matching data. So it's not a perfect expression of what the electorate are thinking, but it's usually pretty accurate. And we've done MRPs before a few elections in the past, and Sean in particular has been spot on when he used to be at YouGov. So it's a very good indicative measurement, and there were some clear patterns in that. So Coalition were being crushed by One Nation, losing 37 seats. You know, they've lost a lot of urban seats, as we said, at the last election. They've only got 9 out of 88 urban seats, which is fundamental to their problem. They don't speak the language of urban Australia. But at least they're holding regional seats. Well, this showed that it was total carnage in the regions with One Nation hoovering up that. One Nation, the Coalition would not have one seat in Queensland, South Australia, WA, Tasmania.
And the Nats wouldn't have a seat anywhere.
Yeah.
But so, in effect, then what you're doing is you're making an assessment in a particular seat. You can't poll them all, of course, far too many of them, but you make an assessment and then, like for like, if a similar seat, you know, with the same kind of demographics, you make assumptions about what's going on there.
Yeah.
That one thing it doesn't take into account, of course, is the popularity of sitting members.
Correct.
And therefore, in Queensland, you would think with the Nationals, there might be sitting members who could resist a swing, and therefore the Nationals could pick up some seats.
It doesn't pick up. We always talk about aided and unaided polling. Unaided is brand, so Liberal, Labor, Greens and so forth. But then you sort of put in there, you know, the name, the Liberal candidate, you know, the name, the Labor MP. And that's when some voters will go, oh, I've met him. He's great. He's fantastic. Oh, she came and spoke at our club's, end of year celebrations. She was very impressive. And so you hope as a campaigner to see that they've lifted the generic or unaided vote from say 42 primary to maybe 45. So they're adding 3 points. So no, it doesn't take for that. And there are some idiosyncrasies that you can never, the MRP is very good, but it always gets foul or wrong. Which is Dai Lee's seat, which is a very complex, and there's a difference in the northern part to the southern part of the electorate, and of course she's a very strong independent candidate.
Yeah, and on One Nation as well, they're picking up rural and regional seats, taking seats from both the Coalition and from the Labor Party, but more from the Coalition than Labor. But it also suggests that they're knocking on the door of the cities. They're right on the edges.
Yep. Barnaby was a bit ambitious about western suburbs, but it did show that a couple of seats on a bad day might fall to One Nation from Labor. But it had them picking up quite a few seats on the Central Coast, so Dobell and those sort of seats. That's an older demographic profile up there. A lot of retirees from Sydney sell up and move to Gosford Central Coast. So it's a slightly different demographic that you'll find in other places around Australia. We also had One Nation winning seats from Labor, like Leichhardt up in Cairns, the federal seat of Bendigo in regional Victoria and so forth.
Hawke in Victoria.
Yep.
Yeah, those sorts of seats. We're 2 years away from the next election, so a lot can happen in the meantime. And it's just a kind of an interesting discussion about what could go wrong.
Yeah.
And what could go wrong for Labor, for a start. Let's do that, and then we'll go back to One Nation, because there's the potential for a recession.
Yes.
Finally, I think there are more positive signs coming out of the United States than we've had in a long time now. The oil crisis just might start to fade, but nevertheless, that's there. Inflation could continue to drive up interest rates. The budget backlash could be as you've explained it. So those sorts of things could impact on the Labor Party between now and then, and they're right on the edge, as you say, in terms of majority government. One Nation, though, there are, I think, significant pressures on them. One is greater scrutiny, obviously, and that will come. It's already starting to come. The internal ructions, their administrative failures, those sorts of things. I know they'll be forgiven for a lot of them because these voters who have defected, they're determined to create chaos if they can. But One Nation is such a an unknown quantity in many senses because we've never seen them up on the stage in this way before. So you'd have to accept that it's still anything could happen.
Yeah. I mean, the client, as you referred, is the Australian Financial Review, who we poll for every month and do special projects like this. Initially, you know, we had no intention of doing an MRP 2 years out because it's ridiculous because there's so much more to run in the electoral cycle. But given the explosion of One Nation, we thought this might be interesting to see if it's landing in the right spots, because it's one thing for them to be polling in the high 20s and coming second on a national sample, but they have to be doing really well in some seats, and we saw that in Farrer. So we thought, let's sample this and see what it looks like. So we did for that, but it's by no means a prediction of what's going to happen in 2 years' time. But there's lots of evidence in the research that we do that this is enduring. She's giving voice to the voiceless. She's their wrecking ball, those people who are frustrated with the two-party system. And I think Albanese has to be very careful with this budget that it doesn't become the sort of grievance point where a lot of soft Labor voters switch to One Nation. There's a real possibility of that because they're frustrated with the two-party system, and this is more evidence. And I think
My view is they're more likely to stick with Labor as a result of this budget. It speaks to them.
I think their vote is already at low levels at 31, 32, not as catastrophic as the coalition.
Well, it's not catastrophic because it's good enough to give you majority government.
Yeah, but he can't afford to lose too many more points.
No.
If he starts getting into the 20s, you're going to start seeing some realignments there.
That's true.
There.
If you get down to 28, then that's a different story. Look, one other thing that I certainly raised at the Writers' Festival about pressures on One Nation was the prospect that national members, when they figure, right, they can't win the next election, and they'll offer themselves to One Nation provided they get pre-selection, right? And you'll get this flood of people wanting to cross from Liberal and Nationals. And I think that would bring pressure on them because their membership, you know, a lot of them think they're a chance for pre-selection themselves. And that could, they could be furious with that kind of an outcome. If Pauline Hanson addressed this yesterday, I think it was, and she said that she doesn't want them.
Yeah.
She doesn't want these defectors, even though she's taken one or two already, but not anymore. It's an interesting approach, and I think she's probably done it for precisely that reason, that she doesn't want to offend the constituency that she already has.
Well, she doesn't want to look like a major party. I think there'll be a few that she'll take, but yes, those comments were hilarious, I thought. It almost sounded like a reality TV show, Coalition Survivor, you know, sort of going on bended knee, sort of married at first sight, sort of begging for pre-selection.
You know, she gave one exception to the rule, and that's Alex Antic, the senator from South Australia. And perhaps that would have been in the works there for a while, but he's now running for, well, he's talking about running for president in South Australia. And his latest comment was this, that he's happier than he's ever been in the service for the Liberal Party at the moment, because he said they've now got the dream team. Angus Taylor, Liberal leader, Matt Canavan, leader of the Nationals, and Tony Abbott as president of the Liberals. So That's it. He's not thinking about One Nation any longer.
Yeah. Coalition doesn't hold a single seat in the House of Representatives in South Australia, but nevertheless, things are going very well.
Emails. Another one from Noah, who we met after the event. He came up and introduced himself. He's a Gen Z voter. And he sent us an email, and he said, "My core values still align with the liberal ideals, but I feel completely disillusioned by the current party establishment. I know a lot of people my age feel similarly, politically homeless. It's not the values we reject, but we feel the party no longer understands them, that is, the younger people, or speaks for them in a forward-looking way. Is there a way back for Noah and his friends? And if there is not, to the Liberal Party, then where do they go?"
Yeah. No, that was a highlight, meeting Noah and his father. And as a new time father, that I love that bit. They were great. And Noah raises a really interesting point, because in a lot of our polling, the coalition vote amongst Gen Z in particular is in the low teens, so catastrophically low. And on a two-party preferred basis, you know, they're only hitting about 30 to 70 to Labor. And millennials is a bit better, but not much better. And the failure for the coalition to communicate to those people is what's driving a lot of this urban crash that they've been experiencing. And I think for people like Noah, it's that economic hope that they need. They need less sort of obsession by the coalition on sort of some of these cultural issues. Some of them are, you know, some of the issues they raise are important culturally, but they're not the most important thing by a long way. You know, it resonates with some voters, but when 75% of the electorate say that the cost of living and housing is their top three issues, like, that's where most of the votes are to be found. And people like Noah, who's, you know, already thinking about his future and housing and career and study and all this sort of stuff, you know, they need to see a pathway, because at the moment all they see is despair.
Yeah. Now, the independents, so much talk this week about the independents forming a party. A party of independents is the ultimate oxymoron. Two competing, contradictory ideas. How can that fly?
Yeah. James Campbell wrote a really interesting column about this some time ago, saying that, you know, a lot of these asset class debates are most relevant in the so-called teal seats, family trusts and so forth. And it was previously only the coalition that was holding that back from changes to those areas. Now, I do support changes to the treatment of property and assets as long as there's income tax cuts, which the Labor government has failed to do. They're talking about it in the third year of the cycle. I think they are going to start coming under pressure, because they're not going to be seen to be relevant and fighting for their particular constituency. Allegra Spender is sort of caught onto it a bit, I think, and she's now walked back some of her sort of qualified support, and she's being a little bit more sort of fighting for her constituents. But I think it's going to become a problem for them, because whilst they won't see the coalition as representing their values, there's been a real values disconnect over the last decade. They could start becoming homeless and looking for another option.
You see, the one of the benefits from them is that it, potentially they could build their strength in the Senate. Mm. And that would be important to them, because as a party, they can then be above the line and really significantly improve their chances of getting elected. But I think at the detriment to the House. What is really fascinating about the Teals and the independents generally is how they've managed to penetrate the House.
Yeah.
And that's what's so important. And because politics is becoming so fragmented, that's important.
Yeah.
They might hold the balance of power after the next election. Who knows? Look, I can understand people. You look at the kind of principles that David Pocock espouses, right? The priorities and the social conscience that he kind of represents. And you can understand if he was to form a party or at least be a part of a new party, that would carve away considerable support, I think, from the Labor Party. In the same way that the Teals took support away from the Liberal Party, I think potentially they could do the same with Labor. But the problem is that what do they lose?
Yeah.
And what they lose is that link back to the community and this genuine sense that they represent not a political party, but the opinions of the community. And I think that's probably the ditch you die in.
I think they've got to seriously reconsider where they go with this. I think there's a very strong argument for them to form their own party. Now, I'm mindful, I'll caveat this, that when Peter Dutton was opposition leader at one point, their primary vote was 42%, so more than double what it is now. So I'm mindful that 42% of voters were prepared to vote for the coalition at that point. Things have changed dramatically since with the surge of One Nation and a seemingly credible option for voters looking for another home. But putting that caveat aside, I'm not sure that any political party can ever get to 40% again on a primary vote. Labor are well short of that, despite being completely ascendant in the House
of
Reps.
Those days are over.
And can the coalition ever get to 42% again? So I don't think so. Historically, they need to be at 45% primary to win. Howard won it in 98, ironically, when One Nation had their first rise in popularity. He won with 38 with a very strong preference flow back from One Nation that didn't win a House of Reps seat. But I'm not sure we're going to sort of see that sort of situation where the Liberal Party can compete across all those urban electorates. So we could be seeing the DLP all over again, where they sort of cannibalise their vote internally, and Menzies had that sort of unbeaten run.
Yeah, but with the Teals, I think the idea of forming a party means that you have to adhere to an extent to the disciplines of that, of a party function. They could say, look, we'll just give conscience votes on everything, and you could do that. But I think that would be confusing within their own communities. I just don't think you can really, a bunch of independents cannot have a national policy that is convincing.
They can expand their map into, electorates like Bennelong and Menzies. And look, are they going to be able to be competitive in seats like Lindsay around Penrith? Probably not.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of middle suburban suburbs, which is kind of beyond those teal areas, which I think are demographically friendly for them. So, they won't get to 40% primary or 76 seats in parliament, but they can be, a partner in a minority government.
Yeah. I just want to mention the changes to unemployment. It didn't get a big run because of a lot of fish frying on the barbecue this week. Look, it's what they've tried to do is to take away some of these onerous time-consuming obligations for the unemployed so that they can go on receiving their benefits. But they came up with a three-tiered system, which I think so that not everybody will be treated in the same way. And that seems to make sense to me that, first of all, the tier one is the people who have genuine obstacles to employment, right? There are certain incapabilities and they have to take that into account. The second group is those who need updated skills, and so they have to be treated in a transitional way and helped out with that arrangement. And then the third are the job ready, and the job ready are treated very differently again. So I think all of that makes sense. The one around obligations is that, is it really necessary for these people to fill out 20 or 30 job applications every week or whatever the requirement might be when they know that they might get one or two job interviews out of that? It really did become just a box-ticking exercise.
And the other issue that's been adjacent to this is raise the rate. The level that it's at is insufficient, inadequate, particularly with inflationary pressures that we've been experiencing and rents being so exorbitantly expensive everywhere. This has been a sleeper issue, I think, for a few years now because economists would say that in the recent years we've effectively had full employment. I know that's not technically true, but in the sense that, you will at some point get a job because, there are so many jobs on the market. But with unemployment going up, this is where the sleeper issue becomes more relevant. And, with NAB forecasting a worst case scenario of 9.5%, if we start hitting those levels, then these sort of issues like raise the rate, but also the compliance measures that are required, they're going to become really salient for not just those voters who are impacted by it, but by their family, their parents or, partners and loved ones. So I think that's going to be a really interesting one to watch.
I just want to raise a final issue about politicians disobeying the rules in a moment, but for the benefit of our YouTube viewers, I'm so accustomed to you coming in here wearing Republican T-shirts. You really do have to explain why this week you've got Kennedy Johnson.
Yep. Friday, 29th of May, is JFK's birthday.
He would have been what?
109 years old.
109.
That was my initial interest in politics. My late father loved JFK and RFK, had a lot of books in the bookcase, RFK especially, whose anniversary is next Friday, 5th of June.
Right.
And so, yeah.
Have you got a T-shirt to match that?
I think there's a RFK Jr. one, but I'm not quite prepared to go that far. But, yeah, I've read a lot of Dad's books on that. And the first book I read, which I've still got, and it's about five different pieces because it was a soft copy, was The Making of the President, 1960, which was all about the campaign written by Theodore White, which is a Bible, because RFK ran that campaign, his brother, in the Hyannis Port compound in Massachusetts. Yeah.
Well, it doesn't matter what's on your T-shirt. I just admire the fact that you wear them in Melbourne when it's almost winter. Well done. We'll take a short break.